From WUOT News, I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and this is Dialogue. Hydraulic fracturing, commonly known as fracking, is a drilling method that allows gas producers to get to natural gas reservoirs that elude other production practices. In the last decade, though, fracking has come under intense scrutiny from environmental and community groups who blame the procedure for water contamination and health problems. Now the University of Tennessee is launching an effort to study fracking by drilling a series of wells in UT's Cumberland Forest. Dr. Kevin Hoy will talk about that project. Later in the hour, we'll hear from an environmental lawyer and a petroleum engineer who will talk about the big picture of fracking in Tennessee. Join us for Dialogue after the news. Six minutes after 1 o'clock Eastern Time on Wednesday, the 3rd of July. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth with you from WUOT News. This is our monthly call-in series, Dialogue. And today, a fascinating subject, one that's been in the news quite a bit recently in Tennessee and in other states around the country. It's hydraulic fracturing, a practice more commonly known as fracking. It is a drilling method that allows gas drillers and producers to get to quantities of gas that in previous decades might have been unavailable because the geology or terrain would have been a little too difficult for conventional methods. Well, once we found out that the process worked and horizontal drilling is a part of that practice that works in unlocking new reserves of natural gas across the country, the practice gained popularity. But at the same time, it also gained a lot of scrutiny, especially from environmental groups. A little later this hour, we'll be hearing from a representative of one of those groups to talk about her concerns about fracking. We'd also like to hear from you as well. You can tweet your questions at WUOTFM. On Twitter, you can also submit a question at our website, WUOT.org, or on Facebook, facebook.com/WUOTFM. Before we get to Gwen Parker, the environmental lawyer, and Mike Williams, a petroleum engineer, they'll be joining us a little later on. We'd like to welcome to the studio Dr. Kevin Hoyt of the UT, and I want to get the title right, UT Agriculture and Forestry.
UT Forest Resources Ag Research and Education Center.
There we go. See that? That's a great crossword clue right there. But yes, thank you for joining us today. And Dr. Hoyt, you're sort of the point man for the university's project to study fracking from start to finish on the Cumberland Plateau in an 8,600-acre tract of land up in Morgan and Scott counties. And I wonder if you would, just for listeners who perhaps have not been following the story very closely, tell us a little about what the project is about.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to engage the listeners on this project. You know, we're part of the UT land grant, University of Tennessee Institute of Agriculture, and we're a land grant institution, and we're charged with doing research, outreach, and education as part of our mission. This research laboratory that we have up in Morgan and Scott County, you know, it provides a place where we can do this type of research on the ground in a controlled manner where we have total control of the project and, you know, we have all the baseline data and, you know, we've had the property since about 1937 and through good stewardship practices over the years, we've brought the property back from a point of similar to what the Smokies were in back in the 30s. It had been clear cut and it had been mined and all those kinds of extraction activities. And through good stewardship practices and putting research projects on the ground, we have this laboratory that we can bring our scientists up and do good science on the ground.
And the effort, as we said in the top of the program, is inherently controversial. It has been in many states. It is here in Tennessee, as we've seen everywhere this has been done. This is a controversial practice. Were you prepared for the pushback that you've been hearing from, especially environmental groups, after the project was announced?
Well, I think any time you do something out of the ordinary or something that's been practiced in another part of the country where there's been some controversy, sure, you're going to have that element come out. People are concerned. We're concerned. We're true environmentalists ourselves. You know, we have good stewardship up there. And so we're going to do this in a very controlled manner with lots of controls in place over and above the Tennessee Department of Environmental Conservation Group's permitting requirements. And, you know, we're going to do some good baseline research up there, and we've been very transparent in the whole process. We've involved stakeholders to come in from the public, from research entities other than UT, collaborators, and we've sought out advice and input from a bunch of different groups to make sure that we do this right, and that's our full intentions. We're going to do it right. We're going to study before, during, and after actual gas and oil exploration on the property.
Yeah, we had a question that was submitted earlier today from a listener, Mark, and no hometown given there. But he says one of the contentious issues is underground contamination of water, particularly well water. His question is whether this study will include extensive testing and retention of samples from the aquifer surrounding the test site before the work begins to establish a baseline. And I think that's what you were talking about just a moment ago.
Well, yeah, some of our scientists from the Biosystems Engineering and Soil Science have already come forward with some ideas about putting water well, prior to any activity taking place up there, water test wells, basically, where we can get good, solid information from a control aspect before we even go in and start doing the activities associated with the drilling.
I don't want to put a geologist hat on you, or a hard hat, I guess that might be the question, on this about this, but you're dealing with a formation that's called the Chattanooga Shale. That exists, it kind of runs under the whole Cumberland Plateau, as the name implies, from Chattanooga all the way up into places like Kentucky and Virginia. And that is the particular layer of rock that we're talking about in this study that would be tapped for potential gas production, right?
That's correct.
And that's about 3,500 feet below the surface, which is below the level of most groundwater supplies. So I'm wondering what your study might indicate about things like that. When you're drilling below the aquifer, what are the possibilities for groundwater contamination if that layer of rock is below the groundwater?
Well, I think some of the experiments that we're going to put in the on the ground will help to find those things out. At this point, from what I understand, the well drilling requires casing to go around it to protect groundwater from flowing back into the well, and getting into the ground. And yes, the aquifer is not near that depth that we're going to be targeting for this exploration activity.
One of the common points of criticism I've been hearing from critics of this proposal is that the university plans to work with gas drilling companies to do that. Is there a particular reason you're working with gas drillers as opposed to bringing somebody else in?
Well, we're not experts in drilling. So we have to have a partner that will come in and come on the property through the RFP process and a lease, and they will do the drilling for us based on minimum requirements in the lease. Our scientists will be over the project, and we have a yet-to-be-named project coordinator, research coordinator, that will really drive all these sub-projects as they begin to happen. But we can't do the drilling ourselves. It's not unlike when we sell timber on the open market. We have a logger, a contract logger, that comes in and cuts that timber and hauls that timber to a mill. It's the same process.
But the university, as we've been talking about, is portraying this as a purely research-oriented study, but there will be some money involved, and I'm talking particularly about money that could be earned from whatever gas may be recovered from these wells. And I wanted to get into that with you just a little bit and talk about, there was an estimate from a Nashville TV station that would be $3 to $5 million a year, but that is sort of hard to predict this far out, isn't it?
What we know about the project is that we'll get a signing bonus of $300,000 up front. Then we will get some portion of the royalty and a land rent. We have put out some minimums in our RFP, so it's really unknown what's going to flow in on an annual basis. We have the first year, we have a minimum requirement of 2 wells, and then at least 1 well per year for the first 5 years of the lease. So, you don't know how much, and economics is going to drive that as well. How much petroleum or gas is going to come out of that well once it's put in the ground. But we intend to reinvest that money back into the project, which is part of our mission that we do on all of our research and education centers.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. We're going to take Terry right now from Brewstertown, and I think I'm getting that right. Terry, you're on Dialogue. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Brendan, Professor. There have been several university studies that have been exposed for being corrupted already, and it's already with what you've just said, it's to the university's advantage to find in favor of the drilling companies. And I'm sure that on these wells they're going to use best practices, but those of us that are victims already of the fracking on the plateau, what do you suggest that we can do? We don't have that money.
May I ask just for a moment, Terry, before I get to Dr. Hoyt, when you say victims, what exactly are you talking about?
My water well, which has been classified by several people as the best water in the country for about 70 years, now has an oily film on it after I listened and finally figured out that there was a drill bit going under my house at some distance, but that's the only, I went outside several times during the night because this thing was keeping me awake, and I couldn't find any other source of the noise until I laid in my bed and listened over the edge of my bed to the floor.
Okay. All right. Terry, let me try to get an answer from Dr. Hoyt on this, and I think what Terry is talking about is last year there was a fracking study that was commissioned by the University of Texas in which the director of the project had to step down from his post. There was a controversy about conflict of interest, and I wonder what measures the University of Tennessee is taking to avoid a similar repeat here.
Well, I am glad that you've asked that question. Our dean is taking great steps to make sure that we don't fall into the same trap or category that some other entities have fell into. We are taking very tough measures to make sure that we have a good policy in place, guidelines in place, and any scientists that work on the project will be required to sign confidentiality agreements, which will be posted on the gas and oil site. So we intend to have a very high level of control and transparency regarding this type of an issue. We're not going to let that happen. We're not going to do anything to tarnish the University of Tennessee or the UT Institute of Agriculture.
Okay, and Terry, thank you for that question. We do appreciate it. And I want to stay on this topic of transparency for just a moment, because I know that a lot of the documents involved so far in the process, and it's still early in the process, have been posted online. I wonder if you'd talk a bit about that.
Yeah, early on in the project, through our communications and marketing department, we felt like it was important to really be out there and be transparent. So we have put everything regarding the project has been posted onto that site. You know, there's a lag time till the stuff gets posted, but, you know, we've got questions that have come in, we've got information about the Cumberland Forest, maps, we've got our UT Advisory Council, which I want to talk about later on in the session about what that's all about. And, we're just trying to make sure that what we're doing, that we're involving multiple stakeholders, and that we're putting the information out there.
Well, since you brought it up, let's talk a little bit about this advisory council that I think there's perhaps a misconception that people think the university is doing so much of this behind closed doors, that the process is taking place without a whole lot of input from outside stakeholders. But on your website, as you said, there is an advisory council listed. Tell us a little bit about the council and how they're working on this project.
Well, we put together an advisory council in February, and it's a multiple stakeholder group that includes landowners, businessmen, environmental groups, practitioners, professional resource managers, industry. We also have some researchers on there and graduate students. So we have an across-the-board array of stakeholders. We have some people that live up in the area, and we intend to bring that group together probably quarterly, 4 or 5 times a year. And what we're going to do is ask them to give us input into the research areas that we intend to investigate. Now, the 5 research areas initially were terrestrial ecosystems, geology, air quality, water quality, and best management practices. We have since added a 6th one on socioeconomic and human dimensions, because obviously that's a huge portion as well. So we bring them together. We've had 2 meetings so far, and we kind of, you know, we have a speaker that comes in and sets the stage on the particular topic. So far, we've covered water quality and geology. And then we kind of brainstorm. We get them to engage to give us ideas for researchable questions that maybe our faculty haven't thought about, focusing on the research. What are some of the things that we can think about looking into if this project is approved and we move forward?
Well, that brings me to our next segment of questions here, because I know your time is running short with us, but I wanted to talk a little about what the next step may be. Looks like the next big hurdle is the Board of Trustees voting on this proposal in October. And what happens if the Board of Trustees gives the green light? What is the next step?
Well, then we have to go back before the Tennessee Building Commission, assuming that we have a viable industry partner that has been identified through the bid process. We'll go back and we'll ask for permission to award if they meet all the minimum requirements. So we could, you know, we're hoping that we have multiple bidders on this project.
Well, even assuming that you found a bidder that matches what you're looking for drilling into the Cumberland Plateau, and that the university approves the project and all of these steps go as you're hoping they will, that doesn't mean that drilling would commence the day after.
That's exactly right. You know, you're probably looking at 18 to 24 months from that time period. I can't predict exactly when it'll happen, but, you know, we'll have to do our baseline analysis and studies. We have to put our research plan together. We don't have a bona fide tied down research plan yet. What we've been doing is talking about researchable questions and areas that we can look at putting on the ground. And the reason we don't have our research plan yet is because we don't know if the project's going to get approved. So we can't really ask scientists to spend a lot of time submitting proposals and going after grants if we don't know for sure that the project's going to go through, because we've got to have that industry partner in order to, you know, do that part of the project. And the other thing I'd like to say, too, is, you know, this whole thing about the research project and doing these kinds of things up there versus maybe the conservation value of the property. Mm-hmm. The property is really, it is a research laboratory. And in our mission, we utilize our land base to do research, whether it's on cows or soybeans or, you know, other plant sciences type questions. And that's what the purpose of that property is up there. So, you know, we're following our mission. We're trying to put good, innovative research projects on the ground. Quite frankly, as the director, I'm charged with bringing the scientists out there, helping them be successful, and also getting graduate students on the ground and launching innovative research projects. And truly, this is an innovative research project.
No doubt about it, and the discussion will continue definitely long after we've signed off today. Dr. Kevin Hoyt is heading up the University of Tennessee's effort to study fracking on the Cumberland Plateau. Dr. Hoyt, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Right. We'll hear more from all of you listeners out there. We've got our phone lines lit up, and we'll hear from you guys. We'll also hear from Gwen Parker. She's an environmental lawyer from the Southern Environmental Law Center, and Mike Williams. He's a petroleum engineer from Nashville. Our discussion continues after a break at 22 minutes after the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue now continues 24 and a half minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock on WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, glad to be along with you. And we had to say goodbye to Dr. Hoyt, but we now have Gwen Parker. My tongue's getting tied today. Gwen Parker of the Southern Environmental Law Center is joining us, and our producer Greg on the line. Do we have Mike Williams? Is he with us now? All right, let's get him in here too. Mike Williams in Nashville with the American Petroleum Institute. Mike, can you hear us?
I can. How are you?
Ah, splendid. We're doing fine over here. How are things in Nashville?
They're fine. Fine.
Well, very good. All right. Well, and we want to hear from you guys, too. We've already got some callers waiting with questions on the line. The number is 974-5050. Before we take a call, though, Gwen, I want to begin with you. You were listening to the earlier portion of the show with Dr. Hoyt.
Yes.
And I know that your group has been involved in placing a lot of scrutiny on this project. What did you hear in that interview? What's your takeaway from that interview?
I think one of the things I'd just like to do for listeners is put this whole proposal in the context of state policy. We have, as Dr. Hoyt said, this transaction would have to go back before the State Building Commission for approval down the road. And that commission has the authority to develop a public policy around disposing of state-owned mineral interests. These are mineral resources that are held in trust for the people of the state, but that policy has never been developed. So what we have are transactions like the UT transaction, and there are a couple of others out there right now, that are being kicked up to the State Building Commission, and dealt with under policies that were really developed to deal with things like leasing office space rather than disposing of non-renewable resources that are held in trust for the people of the state. So I'd just like to put it in that context for folks.
Sure. Mike Williams, Executive Director of the Tennessee Petroleum Council. What did you get out of that conversation we just had?
Well, I was listening to the gentleman, and you know, if the university wants to do a study on hydraulic fracturing, we'll be more than happy to support their efforts. But we're really not involved in that. It's a sort of a, as Gwen said, it's a decision for the building commission and the UT Board of Trustees.
Yeah. Mary on the line from Maynardville, we're going to patch you in right now. Mary, go right ahead.
I would appreciate it if y'all would comment on the need for...
Oh, Greg? I'll be darned. Okay. Wow. Sorry about that. Mary from Maynardville. If you can call back in, Mary, if you're listening right now, 974-5050. We'll try to get you right back in as soon as we can. We'll move on, though, to David from Knoxville at this time. David, if you would go ahead.
Call, please.
David?
Try again.
Oh, darn it. Hold on.
Hang up and then dial your...
Gwen, how are you?
Great, Gwen. How are you doing?
I have rarely had a show fall apart like this one.
It's okay.
Well, let's you and I talk for a minute while we're working out some of our phone difficulties. I know that your group has been pretty concerned about the environmental impact of fracking, not just with this study, but throughout the private industry that's been drilling on the Cumberland Plateau now for many years and in several counties. But with the UT project, I mean, there are environmental voices on this advisory board from... American Forest Management to the Oak Ridge Environmental Quality Board, Tennessee, or the Nature Conservancy, the Clean Water Network, State Environmental Council. Is that sufficient for what your group is looking for? I mean, what's missing from that group?
I don't think it's a question so much as anybody's missing from that particular group. Again, it's a question of the bigger decision-making context this is happening within. Just so everyone knows, SELC is not against fracking. We do think that there need to be adequate environmental protections in place, and we do question whether it's appropriate everywhere. I mean, I think there are some public lands that are too special for it. But that said, the real issue here is not the composition of that advisory council. It's whether we have a good process in place at the state level to protect those special places, to make sure we have adequate environmental protections in place. And we're going ahead with these transactions in the absence of that.
I believe Mike Williams of the Tennessee Petroleum Council is back with us from Nashville. Mike, you on the line?
I am.
I'm so sorry about that.
That's okay.
I want to zoom out to look at fracking in general because we were just talking about that with Gwen Parker here. The Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation recently approved new rules for fracking in the state. That happened last September. The rules just went into effect last month. I wonder if you would sort of brief us on what those rules include.
Well, the first thing to understand is they're not just new rules for hydraulic fracturing. They're new rules for well construction in general, and for the first time, we'll be regulating any hydraulic fracturing in the state. You know, we've been using the technique for about 50 years, maybe 60 years in Tennessee, and it's never been regulated before. These new rules actually regulate it for the very first time.
And Gwen, I would imagine that sounds like a victory for the environmental lobby. That sounds like a big victory. I know I've had conversations with environmentalists as the rules process was going on in 2012, as the hearings were being held and the public meetings and the environmental groups were so vocal about this. But do they go far enough, in your opinion?
The rules are definitely a good step for Tennessee. They make policies that were previously in place for casing and cementing, which are really important for the environment and for safety, the safety of the workers. They make those enforceable, and that's a good step. There is more that could be done. The rules include a 200,000-gallon threshold for some critical provisions of the rules concerning fracking. These provisions address things like public notice and comment, the ability of property owner to have water wells within a certain distance of fracking operations to request testing of their water quality. And that 200,000-gallon limit we concluded was arbitrary and capricious, and TDEC itself said it did not have a technical justification for that gallon, that threshold. We concluded that, you know, regardless of whether the volume of fracking fluids that are used in the treatment, nearby property owners should have the ability, the right to know what's going on, the right to have their water well tested if they're concerned.
Well, we've got Mary, poor suffering Mary from Maynardville. I am so sorry that we cut you off accidentally earlier. Mary, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right, if you would just repeat your question for us.
Well, with what I've heard, I'll modify it a little bit. First of all, our 50 years of experience in fracking is not 50 years of experience in hydrofracking nor in horizontal wells, so we must dismiss that because we've got a really changing dynamic out there. I'm concerned that our regulations don't address the list of the chemicals in the waste and produced water, nor require a chain of custody, nor address methane migration, nor follow the best practices of the American Petroleum Institute. So I'd appreciate comments on those inadequacies in Tennessee's regulations.
Mm. Well, that's something that Gwen was talking about just a moment ago, Mary. And,
yes.
And Gwen, if you want to sort of expound upon that just a bit, talking about how more could be done.
Yes, I'd be glad to. And Mary, thank you for bringing up all of those points. They're very important ones. There is not, disclosure of the fracking chemicals is not required before fracking treatments begin in Tennessee. And as you mentioned, there are other shortcomings as well. Some, in addition to the important points you raised, are things like plugging bonds still being quite low, the lack of an insurance requirement for drillers in the state. There's a lot more that we could do. So we see this as a first step, but definitely just a first step. There's a lot more that needs to be done.
And Mike Williams, I want to turn to you on that because that brings up an interesting distinction between what's called hydrofracking and horizontal drilling. And it seems that horizontal drilling tends to be the more controversial aspect. That's the kind where a well goes straight down and then into a layer of rock. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, horizontal drilling is an advanced drilling technique that's used in combination with fracturing, and it's really led to a huge increase in our nation's oil and gas output, because you can drill one well rather than put multiple wells across an area of land and cover the same territory. It has really increased our oil and gas output with minimal surface disturbance.
Mm. David is on the line with us from Knoxville. He was one that got caught up in the great phone scandal of 2013. So, David, I'm glad you called back. What's your question? Oh no! Wait, do we have? I think we lost David. Is that right? Okay. My goodness. This is, there we go. Did I do that right? No, I didn't. There we go. This is not my
You're
day.
You're doing fine.
I've never had to have a pep talk on dialogue until today. And over such an important topic, I want to make sure our listeners understand we're not trying to make light of this topic. We just have a complicated technological setup today. We had a guest joining us via phone. That's Mike Williams in Nashville. We have a live guest. That's Gwen Parker. We had Dr. Hoyt a little earlier this hour. So we've been trying to keep all of this juggled, and I apologize to our listeners for the quality of the presentation today. Hopefully the information is of great quality. We certainly hope so. Well, I want to jump to a specific criticism that your group, the SELC, Southern Environmental Law Center, has against the university's project specifically. And that's, and I'm quoting, attempting to fast-track the proposal bypassing public forums and state appraisals. But state agencies have been working on the project. It's been going before the commissions, and public meetings have been held. Would you reconcile that for me? I mean, the idea the university does seem to be engaging the proper channels on this decision.
The first thing I'd like to say is that the Board of Trustees, very fortunately, recently decided that it would take up the issue at its October meeting. I believe that's a very important step, and I commend the board for that. I believe that concern that you just read, we voiced back in January. And at that point, I just would like to set out the basic timeline. UTIA had held an open house on the fracking project on December 6th. And after that, we submitted some Open Records Act requests because we just wanted to understand what was going on with this project. While our records requests were out there, UTIA made a decision to seek approval from the State Building Commission. And so we had a process there where UT was seeking State Building Commission approval, and yet the public hadn't had a chance to learn the facts behind the public comments mm-hmm. that were being made. And so we just asked for that decision to be delayed. Fortunately, it was. After that, there was a special hearing held by the State Building Commission. And at this point, as you know, the RFP is out. So that was an earlier concern. But we do still think that there's a need for the public to understand the facts behind these transactions, because, again, they are going up to a State Building Commission that has not yet developed a public process around these important transactions involving mineral resources.
Well, and also to the Board of Trustees,
exactly.
Who has a say in the matter, as you said. And when I talked with Dr. Hoyt, he mentioned that he doesn't know which way it's going to go. I mean, there's no prediction as to whether or not the Board of Trustees will approve or deny. Will your group, I presume, be talking to the Board of Trustees or trying to make a point to these people that have a hand in the decision-making process?
That's an open question at this point, mm-hmm. and it's really up to the Board of Trustees to decide who is going to present information to them, who is going to have the opportunity to voice concern. Mm-hmm. I have heard from students who are concerned about this transaction, from faculty members who are asking, is this the highest and best use of this research forest? There are faculty members who are saying, we can get a lot of grant money to do biological research that doesn't require drilling. Is this the best path forward for the university? And I certainly hope that whole range of voices will be given the chance to present information to the Board of Trustees.
Mm. We'll go back to the lines for a minute. Axel, you've been very patient on the line with us from Jefferson County. Go ahead.
Well, the question I was going to ask actually was directed to Dr. Hoyt, who is no longer on the mm-hmm. on the show. So, but let me just bring it up.
Sure.
Dr. Hoyt reference conflict of interest, but what he talked about was individual researcher conflict of interest that the university is going to address. But what our concern is with the institutional conflict of interest, and that really is the same thing that tripped up the University of Texas's Austin research project, and it tripped up the State University of New York at Buffalo project.
Mm-hmm.
Because here you have a state institution that is going to be deriving revenue to drive a research project, and whether they admit it or not, it's going to be pretty hard at some level to avoid influencing the research to achieve positive results, so that the revenue stream continues.
All right. Well, Axel, thank you for sharing that concern with us. We appreciate that. Gwen Parker is still with us of the Southern Environmental Law Center. I'm getting that right. Center,
yeah.
Right? Thank goodness. Everything else has gone wrong today. And she'll be sticking with us for the next 20 minutes or so. We're going to try to get Mike Williams back on the line from Nashville. He, of course, is with the Tennessee Petroleum Council. We'll be hearing from him, hopefully, in just a few moments. Gwen, before we go to a station break, though, I did want to ask a question about Dr. Hoyt made the point that the Cumberland Forest has long been used as a living laboratory.
Yes.
It's been used for experiments that do involve things like building roads and
yes.
disturbing some natural resources and altering the landscape in some way. What makes this project different from those that have already been conducted with relatively little fuss?
Well, this project is different, and thank you very much for bringing up that point. Unlike logging, for example, that's a renewable resource, these are non-renewable mineral resources that are held in trust for the people of the state, and this is a special category of resources. And because it's recognized under Tennessee law as a special category of resources, deserving more stringent decision-making processes around it. So that's one thing, is just that policy gap, again, that exists at the state level. The other issue, and this is one of the concerns we raised in our letter to the Board of Trustees, was just this is a research forest, but there are different kinds of research that could be done there. And I really wish there were a faculty member on this show who could speak to this, because this is really more in their ballpark. But there are different kinds of research that can be done there, some of which don't require drilling, and that may be kinds of research that could bring in more grant money for the university, or that certainly wouldn't require these environmental impacts. And I think that our main point has been, let's have a review process around this that allows all of those good options to be put on the table and considered by the Board of Trustees. And that's really all we've been asking for.
We'll have more with Gwen Parker of the Southern Environmental Law Center in just a moment. Right now, we'll pause for a station break at 19 minutes before the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Back now with Dialogue at about 17 and a half minutes before 2 o'clock Eastern Time. Afternoon concert with Alan Elstrom will immediately follow, so we hope you stay with us for that. But in the meantime, we have more conversation about fracking and the United States, the UT fracking proposal, UT fracking proposal to study the process, the controversial practice up on the Cumberland Plateau. And we have Mike Williams back on the line from us in Nashville. Mike, you there?
I'm here.
Hey-o. Thanks so much for being patient with us today, Mike.
Okay.
But if you would talk to me somewhat about the environmental concerns. We had a caller a little earlier this hour who complained about a connection that he'd made about some problems with his well water, and he joined us from near the Cumberland Plateau. But the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation says that so far to date we haven't had any complaints of groundwater contamination that have been definitively linked to fracking in this state. Could you talk to us more about that?
Well, you know, if the gentleman had, if that problem exists, it would have been very, very unusual, because the fracturing takes place far below the water table. As a matter of fact, the rules that the department just put in place requires a cement casing 100 feet below the lowest groundwater. And the API standard is only 50 feet below the lowest groundwater, is the way I understand it. So it goes beyond even the American Petroleum Institute best practices in requiring that. It would be very unusual for groundwater to be even near where the fractures take place.
And see, that's an important point. I brought this up with Dr. Hoyt, but I'd like to hear from you too, Gwen, about mm-hmm. this, about the concerns of groundwater contamination. The Chattanooga Shale does exist a couple thousand feet below the water table. So what is the nature of your concern about groundwater contamination when the work is being done below the water table?
The real concern about, I mean, I think the main pathway, and this is not my own research, this is research of experts, is problems with that cementing and the casing that allow the natural gas migration, that I think it was Mary who brought it up earlier, back up through the wellbore and into the water, into the groundwater. That would be one of the main paths of contamination that we'd be concerned about. And there is another problem out there for Tennessee, which is our abandoned oil and gas wells that are recognized by TDEC as well as others as one of the most, as probably the most significant hazard to our groundwater quality in the state. And when you have that horizontal drilling and you have abandoned wells out there, you have the possibility for gas to be pushed back up through those abandoned wells and into your groundwater.
Mm-hmm. But
wouldn't be. It certainly wouldn't be in an oil company's interest to do such a poor job of cementing that they lose their product out of the well into the groundwater. Not only would it be an environmental violation, but it would be, they'd be losing the product, and it would be counterproductive to their job.
And what have you been hearing, by the way, from drillers? Because this is not as huge a deal in terms of the economy, in terms of the busyness of it and the drilling, as you would see in, say, North Dakota, the Barnett Shale of Texas, the Marcellus in the northeastern part of the United States. The Chattanooga Shale is not as huge as those other reserves of gas that we're talking about. So have you heard anything, Mike, from drillers or prospective companies that indicates they wouldn't do business in Tennessee because of these regulations or any effect?
The Chattanooga Shale is thinner than, say, the Bakken Shale in North Dakota. So it won't be as productive at all. And this is not an inexpensive process to do a large horizontal well with hydraulic fracturing. It's very expensive, and unless the chances of being very successful with that well exist, the oil companies just aren't gonna do it. You know, we've talked about the 200,000 gallon limit a couple times, and the way I understand TDOT's the Department of Environment's reasoning there, and I don't want to speak for them, but they looked at what we have done in the past. They've seen that it hadn't been done, causing a lot of problems. So they, that my understanding is, they set a limit that would add a higher level of scrutiny should large operations start coming to Tennessee. So if when we talk about a 200,000 gallon fracture, and I talk to somebody in Pennsylvania and North Dakota, they just laugh at me because, you know, there's no such thing. They don't even they don't even consider those fracture jobs. Mm-hmm. So if the big operations come to Tennessee and we start having really large wells drilled like we're seeing in Pennsylvania, and in the Barnett Shale and up in North Dakota, then those higher levels of scrutiny kick in.
Gwen, I want to toss that back to you for just a moment, because I think one of the concerns of environmentalists across the state is precisely that yes. Since many of the fracking jobs that are done here in Tennessee involve a smaller amount of water pumped down the well, then yes. That kind of excuses them from some of the disclosure regulations that have been enacted.
Yes, and I think the big question there is, well, first of all, it's important to understand the reason why a smaller volume of water can be used in Tennessee is because the frack jobs are shallower, as you pointed out earlier, Brandon. And that means they're in closer proximity to people's water wells. They're in closer proximity to the groundwater aquifers. And you know, it was not a technical decision to choose that 200,000 gallon limit. It wasn't based on any assessment of the risk to people. It's really a question of whether you're going to give a free pass to all the fracking operations that are currently done in the state for basic things like notifying people who have their water wells right near the fracking job. Mm-hmm. I don't think any real justification for that omission has been provided.
Okay. Wendell from Wartburg, you are on with us on Dialogue. Go ahead.
Yes, I thought I heard somebody say about people on the ground. Well, I'm on the ground in Wartburg, and I'm looking at the off my front porch at the Cumberland area there, the reserve. That's a beautiful, pristine area I can see from my house. The Morgan County is a very beautiful area. And I'm just wondering, I have two things to say. One is I disagree, I believe it was with Mike, about the casings, and why would a company want to do a sloppy job and let's lose all their revenue. But look what happened in the Gulf, where the company did a sloppy job and poisoned the Gulf of Mexico. And I guess the main question, though, is, when we first heard about it up here, we couldn't believe it. Why would it?
You've got to be kidding me. Greg? Okay, we're gonna keep going with that. I am sorry about that, Wendell. Jeez Louise. Oh, okay, all right. Right, so let's start from the beginning on that one. He's concerned about, and that's a natural kind of skepticism, I think, to have, both for Mike and Gwen, about companies. They are involved in making money. There's a financial incentive for doing things, and sometimes that doesn't go quite as we expect. And Mike, I just want to hear from you, since he was refuting particularly something that you were talking about. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I was cut off at the time, and I didn't hear his comments.
Oh, we lost you too. Okay. Well, he was concerned about a point that you made a little earlier this hour about companies would be unlikely to do something that would jeopardize their bottom line, like doing poor casings. But he used as an example the BP well in 2010 that had that they found so many problems with in the aftermath of that oil spill and so many corners that were cut. He's, I think, was making the point that maybe there's not a financial incentive, but that it does happen.
You know, that was a really bad situation. Nobody can justify that. And no one, and I'm certainly not going to try. And BP is paying dearly for what they did there, as well as a lot of other companies. But that doesn't mean you just shut down operations and don't drill anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an excellent point too. And Gwen, I just want to come back to you for a moment. As we're approaching the end of the hour, we've got about 9 minutes left in this hour, and so what would you like to see going forward? You were talking about more transparency, and when you say that, how is that defined for you and your group from the University of Tennessee looking to begin and undertake this fracking research project? What mm-hmm. would you like to see more of specifically?
Well, I think there are a number of people who'd like to see more. First of all, I think there's a real need to make sure that the full range of voices is heard on this issue. That includes UT faculty, students, and alumni and nearby property owners who have serious concerns about the proposal. That also includes groups like the League of Women Voters of Tennessee, the National Parks Conservation Association, the Tennessee Chapter of the Sierra Club, the Tennessee Clean Water Network, Tennessee Citizens for Wilderness Planning, and Statewide Organization for Community Empowerment. All of these groups have serious concerns about the proposal, about the whole policy framework within which the UT proposal is moving ahead. And I think that there's a real need for their voices to be heard at the university level, and if the Board of Trustees would provide that opportunity, it would be invaluable, and at the state level, to make sure we have a good process for everybody's views to be heard going forward.
Mike, you are in an industry trade group, the Tennessee Petroleum Council. You work with natural gas drillers and oil drillers, and the university we know plans to work with gas drillers to get this project underway. What are you hearing from people in the industry? How are they looking at this project?
Oh, you know, I've heard from a couple of companies that have said that they were going to answer the RFP. A couple said they didn't think they were going to. Someone will, and someone will be a partner for the university should the project move forward.
Mm. I don't know if you'd be able to answer this question specifically, but we were talking earlier about, with Dr. Hoyt, that the university's incentive for working with a driller is that they know how to drill. What is a driller's incentive for working with a university?
First place, I seriously doubt that the university could do this project without a driller. They can't go out and rent a drilling rig themselves and operate it and do the things the technical things that are necessary and to drill a oil or gas well. They're going to have a partner who is an oil company that knows how to do those things. A company's incentives, I think, would be, first it's an opportunity to put in some more wells. Secondly, if they would benefit from the research that the university would do.
I want to zoom out and talk just a little bit in our closing minutes about fracking in general. We spent a lot of this hour talking about this specific proposal, but as has been mentioned, hydraulic fracturing has been going on in Tennessee in one form or another for close to 50 years. It's a debate that's not going to end tomorrow, that's for sure. And so, Gwen, to have you sort of begin to lead us out just a little bit on this, to talk about what you think the future of this discussion looks like from the perspective of environmental groups who have these concerns.
Absolutely. I think one of the top issues from our perspective would be the issue of opening up state lands for mineral extraction. The UT proposal is one of three proposals that's currently in the works. The other two have to deal with proposals on land that's managed by the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency. And we need a good process around that. We need to make sure there's an adequate environmental review process. We need to make sure that independent appraisals of the mineral value, the mineral resources are done. We need a good, rigorous process around it. A second concern going forward would be to strengthen those regulations that were just passed. They're a good first step, but there's a great deal that needs to be done, that remains to be done. A third step that we'd love to see work on is addressing the abandoned wells problem in Tennessee. And Mike, if your group or any of your constituents would like to work on it with us, we'd welcome that opportunity.
We welcome working with you as well.
Thank you.
Good. Well, there you go. Peace in our time. And Mike, I do want to talk to you as well about the same question. is this kind of drilling, again, we're referring specifically to fracking, getting more popular on the Cumberland Plateau, less popular as you're watching this process unfold? What are you seeing as far as trends looking into the future for Tennessee?
Well, there are going to be more oil and gas drills, wells drilled in the state of Tennessee. Whether they're fractured or not is a different question. Whether they're horizontal drills wells or not is a different question. The Chattanooga Shale holds some promise for particularly for natural gas production, but it's not the resource that we find available in other states. It's not going to be as productive or as big an operation as we see in other states, unless there are some other things come to light, some new technologies are invented.
Yeah, I want to know too what you think, Mike, about some of the controversies that have erupted. We have not seen, obviously, the big controversies that we've seen, as we made earlier reference to, in Pennsylvania, in Texas, Wyoming, Colorado, North Dakota, places where there's really been big public battles about this. In Tennessee, this seems to be a much more, I don't know if I should say civil discussion, but it's been along those lines. Well, what has your experience been like looking at the way the debate is being carried out in Tennessee versus the way it's being carried out in other parts of the country where this practice is happening?
In Tennessee, we are basically talking about the practice itself. We're talking about drilling itself. In, for instance, North Dakota, the debate is boiling over into quality of life and lifestyle conversations. The Bakken Shale is such a resource it's actually changing the face of North Dakota. Some people think it's for the better, some people think it's not, and new people moving in, the population is increasing. They're talking about traffic concerns and housing concerns, crime. They're talking about just social issues in general. Here we're having a very civil discussion about technology and about developing natural resources, and that's about it.
Mm. Gwen, I want to direct the final question to you, which is along the same lines. When you look at how the debate is being handled here in Tennessee, the public discourse and the government discourse, how does that compare to what you're seeing happening in other states?
What I see here in Tennessee is that we're getting into this issue early. We have the opportunity to do things right here. And given the beautiful land that we have at stake and given the importance of well water to other people, I hope we do it right.
Okay. Gwen Parker of the Southern Environmental Law Center, thank you so much for being with us. And Mike Williams, Executive Director of the Tennessee Petroleum Council, on the line from Nashville, thank you for being with us.
Couldn't agree with what Gwen just said more.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Mike.
Oh, this is great. Well, Dialogue is a production of WUOT News, and we'll be back with you, of course, on the first Wednesday in August for our next edition of Dialogue. In the meantime, Afternoon Concert with Alan Elstrom is coming up next. I'd like to thank our producer and call screener and chief cook and bottle washer, Greg Hill, who's been helping me get through this very difficult edition of the program throughout. And, of course, thank you to all of your calls. I wish we'd had more time to get to everybody. Thanks for your questions on Twitter, Facebook, and submitted over the web. Also, this is WUOT Knoxville at 2 o'clock Eastern.